This episode is sponsored by FreeWill. FreeWill is an award-winning social good startup that has raised more than $3 billion for high-impact nonprofits since being founded in 2017. They've been featured in the New York Times, Forbes, and Oprah's magazine, all because their products make things easier for donors who want to change the world and for nonprofits doing heroic work around the planet. They are hiring for a people-focused engineering manager who wants to make an impact at a mission-driven company and lead a team of 3 to 5 engineers. The role is remote with competitive compensation, salary and equity, and a flexible start date. The link to apply is in the show notes.
Welcome to a brand new Techish. It's me, Abadesi of Hustle Crew.
And Michael Behane of Pocket and Techish and a whole bunch of other stuff. Let's get it cracking.
And the world.
And a citizen of the world. So, where should we start? You want to talk about this COVID stuff quickly? Because I think this is affecting everyone now, really.
COVID.
We try our best not to mention it, really, like, because, you know, there's other stuff to talk about and it's pretty depressing. But essentially, in the UK, we've had Freedom Day, which basically means that everything is back to normal. The UK government is essentially pretending that COVID is over and, like, everybody just go about and do your thing.
Lockdown.
Yeah, it's over. It's a wrap, basically. And then I recently read how in the CDC in America is basically telling vaccinated people now to wear masks, whereas once they said you no longer need to wear masks indoors, essentially. This Delta variant is obviously much more contagious. It's the dominant variant in most places that it goes to. It was responsible for what happened in India, where apparently up to 5 million people died. Rough estimates, like, it's potential projections, we don't know. So what say you? And are you're fully vaxxed now, aren't you? Or are you still just one jabbing it out here?
I'm still waiting on my second dose, actually. I tried to appointment yesterday. I tried to get it before I went back to Lagos again the last time. And it's so funny because I didn't think to tell them that I was traveling abroad, but because it was only a few weeks since my first dose, they were like, no, we can't let you have it. And I should have just been like, I need to go abroad. And apparently I could have got it, but I'm still waiting on my second dose, but yeah, I'm going to get it. I am going to get it, and I am still going to wear masks. Mm. And it's funny because, you know, this is such a divisive subject. Look, last time we talked about the vaccine, how many people came back to us and were like, well, actually, guys, you know, have you watched this? Have you read this? Have you seen that? You know, a lot of people in our demographic that were just like, I'm not trusting it. I'm not going to take it. I think this whole experience has made me just a very, like, risk-averse person. Right. I'm very cautious. I want to believe in science. I have, you know, family and friends that are scientists that work in the medical industry. I've also lost loved ones to this pandemic. Mm. And I just feel like I owe it to them to practice safety and be cautious. So I'm getting vaxxed up. I'm going to keep wearing masks. And I don't know, it's kind of weird to me how this has become like an identity thing now. Like, you know, people have like turned their opinion of whether or not to take a vaccine into like a part of their identity. And that's where things start to get complicated, because once something becomes a part of your identity, you no longer need to rationalize it or justify it with evidence. It just becomes something that makes you feel a certain way. And there are certain people that feel a certain way about it. And now there's no way to challenge that. And it's scary to me. Honestly, it's scary to me. Like, I've been vaxxed for as long as I've been alive, you know, in America when I was born. All the doses of everything.
So I wanted to ask you, actually, so then are you moving completely normal, or are you still, are you masked and out there, or are you just at home? Like, what are you doing, seeing as that you're not fully protected, essentially?
So I have definitely been taking advantage of the gym.
Right.
And also, like, classes. Like, I just missed yoga classes. I missed stuff like that. So I am going to those things, but I'm still being cautious. I'll wear my mask wherever I can. I'll wash my hands for at least 20 seconds. Getting tested regularly. Obviously, I was traveling a lot in Lagos and stuff, so I was having to take tests anyway and throughout isolation. But I mean, I wouldn't say I'm kind of like back in the mix the way that I was pre-pandemic. I think there are a lot of like psychological reasons why I can't quite get to that point. But I am definitely doing more things than I did before.
Like I am
going out to eat. I'm going out with friends. And like I said, I'm just going to classes. Like, I wasn't going to classes for like so long.
Yeah.
It's trying to fit into my pre-pandemic clothes.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, actually. So I was with a group of friends, predominantly black young people, and like, I was the only one that had any jab whatsoever. So I don't know how indicative that is of like general like young POC people in London, but I think it might be quite close to it. I don't think people are really fully bought in or convinced. They either think that they don't need it, or they've had COVID before, so it's not a big deal. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not coming here to give a pitch for vaccines, but I do think that if you haven't had COVID, your choice is not between vaccine and no vaccine. Your choice is between vaccine and COVID, because eventually you will get it. This new variant is so contagious.
I would definitely make a case for getting the vaccine. Like, I will put my head on that.
Personally, I'm completely bought into vaccines and I'm on it. But I just think some people are just... The people who are unconvinced, I don't know if they might just switch off if I start saying, yo, the vaccines are the greatest things since sliced bread. I'm just saying that you're unprotected. And, I mean, take that risk if you can. But, I mean, I've seen too many people die and too many people get hurt to
But it's not just about the individual choice. It's about mm-hmm. the impact on a global community when we all take the vaccine, or more of us take the vaccine, right? Like, from mm-hmm. what I have read about what scientists are saying, it's like, not only does it on an individual level reduce your chance of dying from the disease, as a global community of humans, we can like curb the mm-hmm. like evolution and like worse effects of the virus if we're vaccinated. And I think it is really important for people to like remember that part of the argument for a vaccine too. Like, it's not just about its impact on you as an individual, it's about the long-term impact of this virus on an entire global population. And, you know, all of the research that's coming out, New York Times are writing about this, Bloomberg were writing about this, we talk a lot about the gap between the richest and the poorest. The pandemic is accelerating that gap, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's so many countries, you know, we're here in the privileged world, 50%+ vaccination rates. There's so many countries that don't even have a vaccine yet. You know, there's a lot of unrest happening in Iran at the moment because their government aren't letting in any vaccines. They want to develop their own. Sub-Saharan Africa, a lot of countries struggling to get the vaccine other than the most privileged people who've been able to get it through private market. So, you know, what happens then if this virus gets nastier when mm-hmm. so many people, by virtue of where they are, of which they have no choice over, aren't going to get any access to the vaccine? That scares me. It really scares me.
Yeah, because I think this vaccine, this pandemic is like really good at exposing our kind of innate selfishness, because obviously all the rich countries mm-hmm. have just gobbled up all the vaccines. But like you said, if in the global south it just runs amok and then all of a sudden a new variant comes about that it renders the vaccines worthless or inert, then we're all back in the same boat, back to square one, and it's lockdowns all over again, right? So thinking of yourself is not the way we're going to get out of this, but it's a problem because so many people and institutions and countries do only think of themselves. So it's very difficult. I've had conversations with people and they're not thinking, you know, in that macro level. They're thinking, well, I don't need it, so, you know, F it really. Well, I've had it, or, you know, it's not going to affect me, I'm young, so I don't give a damn. And it's difficult. Actually, so the other thing I wanted to mention, so there is now talks of like vaccine passports within the UK. So to go to a nightclub in September, you are now probably going to have to show some proof of vaccinations. I remember back in the day, you were not happy about the concept of vaccine passports. Have you shifted, or do you think this is too much of a coercion? Should it be just through voluntary, you know, convincing people and not coercing them? Like, how do you feel about it now?
I think safety is so important, and a lot of what makes us feel safe is a charade, right? Like mm-hmm. a charade. You know, after 9/11, like, think of how much flights changed and,
oh boy,
you know,
didn't
actually prevent bad things from happening on planes, but it made us feel a bit safer. And I think the vaccine passport stuff is probably more of a way to make people feel safe to do stuff so that the economy can keep moving than it is actual, you know, protection. So it's worth experimenting with just to see, because the truth is the Great Return or the Great Freedom Day hasn't really moved the needle in any significant way. Like, Bloomberg did this really good article where they compared like commuter hubs in London, the Monday before Freedom Day and then the Monday of Freedom Day. And there was like literally no difference. Like, they were all deserted. Like, they were empty. And I think we have to start thinking about the long-term consequences on the economy and therefore on society and individuals like of this time. And yeah, if that's going to get people doing stuff, then let them do stuff. And if it's so restrictive because some people are not going to take the vaccine and shouldn't be denied access to culture, then like revoke it. But let's just like see what happens.
I fear it may
backfire. I reckon people are going to waive it. I feel like people are going to get to the door and the bouncers be like, oh, okay, go in. Like, you know, when you like were trying to club when you didn't have ID?
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, let me see your ID. And you're like, oh no, I forgot it. I left my ID at home. They'll be like, oh, it's all right. Just go in then.
Yeah. I saw like a meme where it was like the vaccine passports and it was like a $50 note, basically, like, or like a £50 note. But that means that shit will get expensive though if you want to go out partying. But what I will say is that I feel like it may backfire because it's a very transparent attempt just to force young people to get vaccinated. Because to be fair, what difference does it make? If you test negative, you should be able to go out. Do you know what I'm saying? If you test negative or you have antibodies, you pretty much are as safe pretty much as somebody who's vaccinated, kind of. I haven't got the exact data, but I would imagine
so
that.
So what they're gonna do, like make you do like a little PCR test?
Well,
like,
they're not gonna do it, but they, you know, I don't know how it would work, but there is a way of demonstrating that you're negative. I don't know, it's, you know, it, to get into certain venues, I'm assuming. But the fact that it's just like you have to be vaccinated and vaccination only is the only thing that we're going to take, it's obviously just to get young people to get vaccinated. And I don't have a problem with that, you know what I'm saying? But I do think, I hope it doesn't backfire where people kind of resent it and fight against it. But we'll see. We'll see. Enough COVID
why,
talk anyway,
why do you
man.
Want people to resist when you're fine? Anyway, you're going to get in.
Yeah, it's true. I'm good. I'll be partying away. So the Chinese stock market, or the Chinese stocks, tech stocks, have taken a massive hit recently. They've gone down. I was listening to another podcast and an investor was complaining about how his, you know, his portfolio has been absolutely trashed. And a big part of it is because the Chinese government is now clamping down on their tech industry. They are trying to control the excesses. It all started, obviously, with Jack Ma. Jack Ma came out and said something about how, you know, the regulators are stifling innovation. Then from there on in, they blocked one of his IPOs. I think Didi, which is their kind of Uber, has now had some restrictions placed on them. And I wanted to do a deep dive. Obviously, you know, none of us here are Chinese. We don't speak Chinese or Mandarin, so we're outsiders. Wow. And I wanted to, there we go. And I wanted to kind of understand it a bit more. And I found a commentator on Twitter who seems to know a lot more about it than me. And they basically said that they've changed their thinking and they're going for a new model. They're trying to go away from the Silicon Valley model, which is growth at all costs, unprofitable companies. You know, for example, WeWork was the most valuable company in the US at one point in terms of its valuation, or private company anyway. And then obviously what happened, it disappeared, right? I don't think they want those kind of situations anymore. So they're saying that, number one, the company cannot go against national strategic interests, basically. So you can't be like manufacturing offshore. You can't be pretty much setting up headquarters overseas. It's got to be all kind of in-house, building up China's capacity. Number two, it has to be sustainable with real profit or a social benefit, and not just capital gains, which is basically the entire Silicon Valley model, which is basically valuation upon valuation. Let's just get the next round, the next round, the next round, and we'll exit and sell it to the next sucker, basically sell it onto the public markets. Who the hell cares, basically, if the stock goes down? Thankfully, most companies seem to be doing okay, but, like, you know, it wouldn't bother the VCs really if they, you know, they sell their shares onto the next sucker, basically, right? And one thing that I found was interesting here, I think here, what was it? I don't have the quote, but I think they were forcing one of their delivery companies to basically pay minimum wage at least. So I think, I'm not going to sit here and frame China as, like, you know, benevolent angels, but I do think they're smarter than the West for quite some time, in the sense that not only did they say Facebook, Google, you know, Amazon and whatnot, you can't just come into our markets and dominate. We're going to build our own versions. Then after that stage of being the copycat clones, now the Western companies are copying many of the features of the Chinese companies. Like, I go on TikTok and I'm like, this is light years ahead of anything that I'm seeing, right? So they built up their own capacity and then now they're able to kind of go forth and dominate. Whereas in Africa, we're just like, you know, WhatsApp and Facebook are our thing, basically. We don't have nothing there that rivals anything that the US are doing. So I don't know. What do you think? You've been to China. They obviously do things their own way.
Yeah.
You know, is this too authoritarian? Would you like to see things like this done here? Will this stifle innovation for the future Chinese Jack Ma? Like, will he be like, what's the point if I'm going to get in trouble? Like, or, you know.
I think it's really interesting the way that we are interpreting it. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we have this interpretation that the Chinese government identified that this growth at all costs was creating some, you know, unintended consequences that they weren't happy with. So in the Bloomberg article that I was reading, there were things like, you know, smaller companies being forced into larger tech companies' ecosystem, which is something that we've seen Google do with the Chrome Store, Apple do with the App Store. That ultimately is like anti-competition, right? Which isn't great for consumers. But yeah, that same point again, like, you know, what have we actually learned from that, you know, Silicon Valley, you know, growth at all costs model? What does it actually do in terms of like net gain for social impact and things like that? And people have realized, we have so many examples of this, that actually, you know, if you're optimizing for growth, you're pretty much only optimizing for that and not very much else. So I think there's definitely like positive reflections for us to take from this. But at the same time, I don't want to oversimplify and just say, oh, wow, look at them trying to have a more conscious type of consumerism, a more ethical type of capitalism, because it is still China. Like, it is still one of the manufacturing hubs of the world. And we know what the conditions are really like for people on the ground in China. And we know why people still go to China for manufacturing. They ain't got the same labor laws as us. They have different working hours. They have, you know, crazy long hours, crazy long days. So I feel like before I start building a case for how China's version of capitalism is more conscious and ethical than ours, I'd need to address more than just how they're treating big tech.
Yeah, I don't think for a split second it's more ethical or more consumer friendly or anything that you mentioned. I think it's just smarter from their perspective in terms of whatever objectives they want to achieve. They emphasize essentially what are the kind of national objectives, whereas we have this, like, you know, laissez-faire, free market, and it can in the end harm the majority of people, but so long as it enriches a few billion, it's all good, basically. Right. And I've heard it said that in the US and the West, the billionaires control the government, and in the China, the government controls the billionaires, right? And I'm not saying which one is necessarily better, but I just think they're just much more strategic than us. They haven't bought into this crap that, you know, complete unfettered capitalism is the way forward. They found capitalism and they've tweaked it to fit their way, to fit their society.
Yeah.
Obviously, a whole heap of problems, you know, with the country, and I don't agree with everything they do, no way, Jose, but from this perspective I just think they're smarter. And if I was a developing country, I wouldn't be looking to the Western model per se. I enjoy democracy, freedom of speech, free, you know, rights. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about purely on an economic level. I feel like when the government has a strategic objective and it's focused on growth and focused on distributing as much economic value across society, it's a lot better than what we have here, which is basically let's let Jeff Bezos go to space and, you know, doesn't make a difference. Like, who, you know, people could be starving, doesn't make a difference, basically, right? But it's interesting.
But what is your metric there? Because I don't kind of get the point you're trying to make there. I'm going to challenge you on that. What are you saying?
I mean, the reality is China has taken more people out of poverty than anyone, any country, any system in the history of capitalism or in the world, full stop, basically, right? So their system isn't necessarily just set up to enrich a few billionaires, which is what we have here. So what I'm saying is many developing countries have consistently been told laissez-faire free market capitalism is the only way to develop your country, is what I'm saying to you. And China has proven that that is not the way necessarily forward. That when the government... And this is not just China, you know, even if you look at countries like South Korea, Japan, the government has a much more active role in pushing capitalism in a direction. I don't believe in communism where the state has complete control. I think that's not clever. But I do think the opposite, which is unfettered libertarian capitalism, is equally as stupid. I think you need a balance, and I think they have struck a balance that is better in terms of developing a country. Now, as an individual, as a citizen, in terms of the social rights, I'd much rather prefer the West, 100%. But in terms of economic development for poorer countries, which is what they were 30, 40 years ago, like they were one of the poorest countries in the world, and there are still parts of China that are, I think their system is smarter, if you get what I'm saying. Does that make sense?
I feel like I need to fact check if China was one of the poorest countries in the world 40 years ago.
It was
top 10 poorest countries? Like, define that, categorize that.
Well,
I know the Cultural Revolution did good stuff, but I just feel like I want to, like, qualify some of those statements with data.
No, I mean, they had hundreds of millions of people in poverty, much more so than they did now. It actually was a poor country, no doubt about it. The communism didn't work in developing the economy, it didn't. And Deng Xiaoping, he was the leader who basically said, it doesn't make a difference if the cat is white or black so long as it catches mice. Essentially saying, forget whatever system we have, let's just have something that works and be pragmatic, as opposed to let's be an ideologue and say communism, you know, and, you know, Marxism and whatever and whatnot. Let's just do something that works. And I prefer pragmatism over ideological positions. And I feel like sometimes in the West, we are so ideological with free market capitalism that we cannot do things that make sense because we are so tied to the idea that the state must not get involved and we have to let free individuals make whatever choices they want in terms of allocations of capital, in terms of, you know, whatever they want to do with their business. And I think in the long term, it hurts us. If you get what I'm saying.
I think another interpretation of this is that the consumer internet industry of China is starting to get a lot of power, right? Mm-hmm. It has huge user bases, incredible amount of public attention, a lot of leverage in terms of the influence and engagement it has from its users. And it's becoming something beyond the control of bureaucrats and government. And, like, it could also just be a flex to get those folks under control and within, you know, the realms of their authority again. And I think that's something that we're seeing happening on the other side of the world too, right? Mm-hmm. It might be a bit of a delayed reaction, but governments in the US and beyond are trying to take a more interventionist approach with big tech because big tech is so friggin' big. It's now, like, impossible to control and has almost more power and influence than them, certainly more data.
Mm-hmm.
So I do also think, like, this is a response to basically, like, a fear of a power imbalance.
I think you're right, 100%. I don't want anybody to think that I'm saying that it's that simplistic. This is also a power grab from the central government of China, where they're saying, don't forget we're the boss also, we're in charge here, right? Basically, you know, this is not a democracy, so any kind of threat to their kind of center of power has to be stifled. So I don't think it's completely just like, how do we benefit the economy? How do we benefit our citizens? Yeah. It's also like, yo, don't forget, I'm the one in charge here, basically, right? Very complex, very interesting situation. We'll see how it goes. This might end up being a problem for them. Maybe it does stifle innovation. Maybe the future investors and entrepreneurs don't want to work in China. Maybe they're scared to do something. Maybe there's no point. They might say, what's the point if I'm going to get in trouble, right? Mm. So this could backfire. I don't want to paint this as like a simple dimple, like it's a complete great idea, but we'll see. I want to see how it plays out. Personally, would I own Chinese stocks now? I don't know. I don't know if I would, actually, to be honest. That you know, would I buy Alibaba? It's probably heavily discounted based on what's happened, but it's very difficult when you can't predict what the government will do next. So that's also a problem, I guess. What are you gonna say? Side note, what
if you're a dictator? Mm-hmm. Would you use a cultural revolution tactic to revolutionize your country?
Define cultural revolution though. What do you mean?
Will you pull a Chairman Mao?
No, of course not. Nah, man. I'll be like a benevolent dictator. To be honest, will you now?
Yeah, like Mugabe.
No. Shout out to my white farmers. No, I'm joking. The leader that I probably do admire the most over the last 100 years is a guy called Lee Kuan Yew. He's like the founder of Singapore, essentially. And he turned Singapore from like third world to first world in like 20, 30 years, basically. And he kind of he wasn't the dictator. He won elections. But anybody who wins elections for 30 years in a row, I've got a kind of side eye to a certain extent. And he was a bit authoritarian. But in terms of being like just the ultimate pragmatist, I respect him the most. And for example, like one thing that would never happen in the West, but they're a multi-ethnic society. It's 30% Chinese, Malay and Indian. And they had some race riots. So he said, you know what, we're going to give government housing, but each government housing has to be 30% Chinese, 30% Indian, 30% Malay, so that we can never have a situation where we just have enclaves of like differing ethnic groups in different areas. Now, to us in the West, we'd be like, wow, that's such an affront to personal freedom. I should be able to live where I want to live. But if you're trying to manage a society where things can go left and you can have riots and racial tensions and people not liking each other and people don't mix, it is kind of genius. But that's how pragmatic they were, and it worked. Mm. The results are the only thing that matters. I'll definitely recommend everybody to read his biography.
A pragmatic dictator. I wonder what kind of dictator I would be.
Tyrant. Tyrant. I've never seen a tyrant. Everyone has to read bell hooks, otherwise you get lashes, basically.
The world would be a better place, though. I also wonder if we have any techish listeners in China. I mean, I guess there's a bit of a language barrier. Maybe we should.
Yeah, maybe not.
I would love to know.
We have some in Taiwan, and I won't mention whether that's China or not, so I don't want to get in trouble, but yeah, there's some in Taiwan.
Don't take us there.
Okay, cool.
This episode is sponsored by Podia. They are building the most creator-friendly platform on the planet to help people sell online courses, memberships, and digital downloads. They are hiring for a super friendly, tech-savvy, experienced support agent who can advocate for our creators, foster a sense of community, and help them make sales. The link to apply is in the show notes.
So Facebook wants to help you connect with the Alpha and the Omega, God himself. So they are in talks with like different churches, different synagogues, different mosques about how you can use Facebook to get in touch with your congregation and build that kind of and foster that kind of religious connection. I know during the lockdown, a lot of churches had to kind of...
This is a new low for Facebook. Sorry. I can't even... I'll let you finish.
Don't Kanye me, Taylor Swift. So they are looking at ways.
Houseway.
So I know during the lockdown, a lot of churches used Facebook to kind of live stream their services because obviously you couldn't attend. It does make sense though when you think about it. So they're talking to Hillsong, which is kind of like the trendy young people church, right? Where you can wear jeans and tattoos and whatnot.
Bieber's church,
right? And a few people that I know actually. And they're working on things for like financial giving, so tithing, streaming. It does kind of make sense though, don't you think? Because it's like older people generally tend to be more religious and go to church. I know there's probably young people listening or church going, but on average, who's on Facebook? Old people, right? But it is like what you said about Netflix and gaming, where it's like, why do you have to encroach on every market? Just let it be. Like, do you not have enough Frisbee right now?
Come on. Okay. Where do I even start unpacking this? Okay, the first thing I'm going to say is, like, I don't like the idea of someone who doesn't believe in God benefiting from the commercialization of religion. And if I've learned anything from my 10 years working in tech, including times in Silicon Valley, it's that most tech people are atheists. Like, at best agnostic.
A lot, right? Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, they believe in the God of the Almighty Dollar. That's what they believe in. That's their God. But no, anyway,
like,
go on, carry on.
Dude, like, there are times where, like, as a Christian in the room, I have just genuinely, like, wanted to, like, not even mention the fact that I'm a believer because mm-hmm. I just didn't want to get torn to shreds for the fact that, like, oh, come on, like, you consider yourself an intelligent, intellectual person? Like, you don't think the Big Bang happened, blah, blah, blah. I was like, I don't want to have to defend my faith to you, okay? Right, like, yeah, I'm a believer. Yeah. Like, it makes sense to me. You know, fuck off. But so the first thing is, like, as a Christian, I have to say this... It makes me feel very uncomfortable because I just don't really believe that there are believers in this business. I also don't feel like, you know, with the track record they have from Cambridge Analytica onwards, they have behaved in a way that suggests to me they're like particularly like ethical or motivated by the tenets of the Bible. So that's just like the first thing I have to say where I'm just like, that just makes me feel super uncomfortable as someone, who identifies as Christian. And then the second thing I want to say is like exactly what you said, like, come on, like is literally like nothing sacred anymore, like even to the point where like a religion is now like the next frontier. Like, I mean, there's so many interpretations of this. Like, one, is it just like, let's go where no one else will go, or is Amazon now gonna start offering some stuff, or Netflix is gonna now start competing for like live streaming church? I don't even want to know. It there's something incredibly cynical about seeing like believers as like a last frontier or like a growth opportunity. Like, don't get me wrong, like if I take my faith hat off and just see it from a business perspective, I mean, maybe it makes sense, but I just cannot extricate that part of myself. And seriously, so this just makes me feel, it just makes me feel really uncomfortable. And I just think it's just like, come on. I mean, at the same time though, because we have spoken on the show before, like I have spoken on the show before about starting a cult. You know, if times get rough, I'ma do it. And what I've realized is, because I was recently watching the Hillsong documentary that was on BBC Storyville. I don't know if you've seen it, God Goes Viral, but
I
was watching that and I was hearing about, you know, all the pastors and like the salaries they're on and the benefits and this, that, and the other, like, not gonna lie, I was kind of like, that seems like a pretty good job. Pretty good perks. And then I realized I don't need to start a cult. I can start a church, because people that run successful churches are making bank. Like, oh my goodness. Was just like, wow. Now, obviously that comes with a responsibility, right? Like, you can't just like make money for the sake of making money. You then need to pour that money out into the will of God. But I did kind of start thinking, I was like, no one needs to reinvent the wheel when it comes to religion. Really?
Yeah.
People are already there waiting for you to give them something. And then the formula's there for you to share. So you just need a new way to share that formula for the people that are already waiting to receive that solution. So I was just like, God, techish church. Kanye is doing it. No one's stopping him.
I was on a Zoom call with like 20 or 30 like top media entrepreneurs. Somehow I finessed my way onto this call and they're all running companies worth doing like $100 million a year. And one of them said, like, just look to church. If you want to see the business model, look to church. Foster's community, the tithing, the merchandise, you know. And I was like, damn, you're right. He was like, it's been done already. It's been invented. You just got to go there and look, right? And I was like, wow, that's such a cynical take, but it's also such a clever take, right? How do I feel? Obviously, I'm not really religious, so I don't have that ickiness factor. I find it icky in the sense that Facebook is just never-ending in terms of its growth. But at the same time, though, if you look at the pandemic, there are many people who can't physically go to church, right?
Yeah.
Why can't they have something where they feel like they can attend and be involved in a way where, like, you know, it's there and available for them? That's the positive case. The negative case, obviously, is that someone who doesn't go to church, but I often admire church because I'm like, it's a great community. It's a great place to get out of your house every Sunday, see the same people, share your trials and tribulations and whatnot. And this, that might be the last bastion of like real world community. Like, most of us are now just doing online communities. Most of us are just texting and WhatsApping our friends. It's hard to organize a link up with people now. It's like, but if you have this thing where it's like every Sunday we must go, it's interesting. Yeah.
But I just feel like if you are going to benefit from this, right? Because Facebook's going to make money. Facebook doesn't do anything unless it's going to make money off of it, right?
Right, yeah.
Can't it be on a platform that gives back in some way? Like, don't get me wrong, I totally understand that like virtual meetups are going to happen anyway. If not Facebook, YouTube. If not YouTube, Zoom. Like, either way, big tech are going to get in on this. I get that. But I just wish that this partnership, you know, would happen with a platform that, you know, Facebook doesn't need that money. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't need that money. Like, can't this opportunity be with an emerging company or like another platform? Yeah, exactly. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I think that's the annoying thing where like this obviously seems like a startup idea. and it would be perfect for a startup. I don't know if there have been ones that have tried it to kind of be the kind of platform for religious, you know, services, but maybe it didn't work. And maybe Facebook, just because of its engaged audience, is just the best place for it. Like I said, there's old people on Facebook and they're just going to understand it, and it's going to be a lot easier for them to kind of do their thing. Yeah, let's see what happens. I mean, I think it's just initial discussion stages. I don't think they've actually built anything or they're actually going to release anything as of yet, but interesting times.
So we'll talk a little bit about Simone Biles pulling herself out of the team event at the Tokyo Olympics and citing Naomi Osaka pulling herself out of the French Open as inspiration for that. And, you know, there are a lot of conversations happening now around this trend of people putting their health before glory, before status, and what a positive sign this is. And I think, you know, I would definitely agree that it's like a really positive sign that people now feel safe enough to put their health before anything else, but it's not without backlash, right? So, you know, as soon as Naomi Osaka was like knocked out of the Olympics, everyone's like, should she even have competed? A lot of people are saying, you know, Simone Biles is like copping out. She is still competing in the Olympics. She's only pulled herself out of the team event, so she will be back. We'll get to see her again. But yeah, I personally think it's a good thing. Like, we're in a process of redefining what matters to us as individuals and as a society. And we're in the process of redefining glory and redefining legacy. And I think it's not just about the numbers on the board and all that stuff. It's also about the way that you did it. And if you're doing it in a way that's sustainable and true to your values, then that should always be applauded.
Yeah, I think Gen Z is kind of cut from a different cloth as well. I think they're just much more aware of like mental health and its importance. So yeah, if you don't want to do something, fuck it, don't do it. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not like, long, right? Yeah, I think us millennials pretty much, I think we
suck from the Kool-Aid too much.
I think we still kind of got one foot in the old world because we grew up in that world. And I think Gen Z, just smartphone natives, kind of realized that, yo, if I don't take charge of my mental health, this thing can take me all the way down. I mean, there's a lot of pressure.
There's
I
wouldn't want to be whiny bastards. No, I'm
joking. Yeah, interesting.
Hey,
actually,
I love you.
One quick thing, actually. I saw one thing about how Gen Z, like, is the only group. Millennials don't have a problem with cancel culture, where Gen Z does have a problem with cancel culture. They just surveyed them. And it's a small sample size, so I wouldn't imagine that it's like a massive sample size. But I do find it interesting looking at the differences between Gen Z and millennials. And my theory was as to why Gen Z is like most... whether you think cancel culture is real, but Gen Z was less sympathetic to the concept of cancel culture is because they've grown up online. Whereas I think a lot of millennials are like, they remember a time before they were online. So all of their stupid statements and things wasn't there, pretty much. So they have the sanctimony to... they are like arrogant enough to be like, yeah, I got no problem with cancel culture because, you know, I got nothing to hide, basically, right? Whereas Gen Z is like, well, actually, like, I grew up on the internet and all my dumb stuff is on the internet, so I'm probably more sympathetic to people who have dumb stuff like and get exposed. So I think the disparity between the two generations is interesting.
My argument for that would be that millennials are basic. Like, every generation, our comprehension of consciousness
evolves. Yeah.
And as does our ability to process the world around us and interpret the information that we receive. And I think that by virtue means that we can enjoy the complexity of life and the nuance of life more with every generation. So, you know, cancel culture is inherently black and white and simplified, right? It's this idea that like, no, you're this you're that bad, whatever. And, you know, my argument would be that Gen Z realize life's a little more complicated than that.
Fix up, millennials. We need to get smarter. Anyways, cool.
Basically.
Yo, everyone, thank you for listening. That's been this week's Techish. Hit us up, hashtag Techish, on the interwebs. We're on at TechishPod on Twitter and Instagram. And leave your review. It really helps us shoot up the charts. We've been climbing high. Downloads are going through the roof. So thank you, everyone, for listening and supporting. We'll catch you next week. Peace.
Bye.
Bye-bye.